You're listening to episode 211 of Women Worldwide. How does the social entrepreneur create global change? I've got a guest today who's going to share what it takes to survive the startup phase, heighten awareness, and drive impact. So stay tuned to learn more. Hi, I'm Deirdre Breckenridge. I've spent an entire career helping women to share stories, nurture relationships, grow their brands, but most of all, to find their voices so they can make a difference. Do you feel stuck? Do you want to power up your own voice? Women Worldwide features the stories of passionate women who have navigated big career challenges and some of the toughest changes. These professionals offer deep insights and advice to inspire you and to help you uncover what's holding you back. Let Women Worldwide ignite your passion so you can excel in life. Welcome to another episode of Women Worldwide. Get ready for a guest today who's going to inspire and motivate you to step out of your comfort zone. But before you meet my special guest today, I just want to take a moment to say thank you. We really appreciate how much you are tuning in every single week and you're sharing feedback. You're letting us know that the stories of our guests are really helping you and that their advice is making a difference. So keep the feedback coming. Let us know how you're doing, how you're feeling on Twitter, Facebook. You can rate us on iTunes and sign up for Women Worldwide emails on our website too. All right, let's dive into today's topic. It's a big one, scaling global change, which actually happens to be the title of Erin Ganju's book. Erin, who is the book's co-author, is here to chat with us about the social entrepreneur and surviving the startup phase, which we all know is not easy. So just a little bit about Erin's background before she jumps in. She's the managing director at Echidna Giving Fund. She's also the co-founder and emeritus board member of Room to Read. And from the early startup days of Room to Read, Erin was instrumental in the design and implementation of the organization's scalable, replicable model for improving the quality of education around the world. And it was actually in 2009, she became the chief executive officer and she oversaw Room to Read's global operations across 15 countries. But even before co-founding Room to Read, she worked at Goldman Sachs, Unilever, and several technology startups. So I could go on and on about Erin, but it's so much better that she shares her story with you. Erin, it's great to have you on my show. Welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here with everyone at Women Worldwide.
Awesome. Well, oh my goodness, big topic today, scaling global change. And you are the perfect person to be tackling this topic. I want to dive into your background because, you know, you came out of the financial world, right? You're at Goldman Sachs and here you are today, managing director of Echidna Giving Fund, and you're an emeritus board member and co-founder of Room to Read. Tell us kind of what was behind this transition into your career.
Well, I think the connecting line throughout my career has really been working internationally and finding ways to really collaborate across cultures to create change. So whether that showed up in my early years in investment banking, which was, you know, 25 years ago now, before many banks were working globally, it was a new expansion strategy for them. There was a lot of crossing borders and understanding how to make business work across those borders. And that's certainly as I moved into the social sector, when we started Room to Read in the early 2000s, and we were asking people to help support educational change in remote communities, you know, Asian Africa. It was at a time when that was, you know, not so common, and international development projects were looked at a little wearily. And so I think that was now something that has changed a lot, and it's been wonderfully a part of, you know, being able to make those connections and help people see how important it is to think about investing across our borders and really looking at the world more holistically.
Yeah, I mean, it's really cool that you were sort of in on the ground floor as, you know, even banks themselves were learning to work globally. How did that feel as a woman in banking doing that?
Well, it certainly is an industry that is not does not have as many women in it as men, as we could see across many sectors and many business lines now. I would say that for me, in those days, early rankings, the start-off kind of structure of analysts that you see in investment banks, we were almost probably 50% of my incoming class. But what is a common theme in many sectors, as you see, as you go up the ranks, women start to drop out in greater numbers. And so for me, early in my career starting out, it felt really incredible to be a part of a dynamic group of men and women. But certainly I was one of those that didn't necessarily see myself in the leadership ranks. And so I chose another path, like many women do.
Right. And is that how you sort of came upon Room to Read? Now, you also have a new book that's out, and I'm hoping you'll share a little bit about it. It's called Scaling Global Change, A Social Entrepreneur's Guide to Surviving the Startup Phase and Driving Impact. What made you want to write this book? And maybe you can share some of the big takeaways.
Definitely. Well, I will maybe start with just sort of the aha moment, I think, for me and that career change from the for-profit to the nonprofit side. I think of really as like an early midlife crisis in my 30s when I was part of the founding team of Room to Read. I feel like after investment banking and the dot-com startup world, I really was questioning why I was working so hard for causes I didn't really necessarily care as deeply about. And so it was really sort of a life of change and a change to really focus more on aligning my work with my values. And that was really the pivot for me behind moving into the social sector. And I'm a big believer that, education is a great equalizer and was deeply passionate about being able to provide children, no matter where they were born, in the world, that opportunity, especially for girls, given we have a really large girls' education program at Room to Read, to have the access to quality education. And so all of that passion, if you will, is what drove me. And I think that's what drives any social entrepreneur. And so when we, came to writing Scaling Social Change, myself and my co-author, Corey Heyman, we were trying to really create the how-to guide for social entrepreneurs to turn that vision of change that they have and so deeply believe in into something that could really scale. And the key behind the book is that what it takes is often really building a strong organizational foundation to do that. It's not just about the work and the passion, but it's how do you build a healthy, social enterprise that can grow and scale and have greater impact.
So what do you think, I know in general with any startup, they say that the first 5 years are the toughest. Mm-hmm. And if you can get over that over that 5 year hump, you've sort of made it. You can then, I guess, pop the bottle of champagne and celebrate. So, you mentioned the infrastructure. What do you think are some of the other greatest challenges for social entrepreneurs today?
Well, it is. I think you have nailed it. It's, crossing that chasm between the kind of enthusiastic startup years to the more mature, kind of worldwide or at least, larger brand recognition and influence. Those are, very difficult, chasms to cross. And so at the beginning years, you really get a lot of enthusiasm around being the new kid on the block and having a new idea or innovation. But what it often takes is, a really strong programmatic effectiveness and evidence of the fact that your new innovation is working. And then you have to focus on strengthening your operational excellence, because it's not always what you're doing, but sometimes how you're doing that's just as important, particularly internationally when you're working in complex countries and cultures with a lot of variability, in the context that you're working in. And so that, that challenge of strengthening operations and then pulling that into the greater strategic influence and a systems-wide change, those are huge barriers that you have to find a way to, knock down and kind of move through. And so the startup days, I think, turning into the mature organization is really all about that trajectory of figuring out how to build the organization's, learning kind of iterative process to responding to barriers and overcoming them that is so important.
Do you think social entrepreneurs are good at surrounding themselves with the right people to help them overcome those challenges?
Well, interestingly, a lot of the research you see that in the social entrepreneurship space now shows that, of course, one of the key challenges you face early on is raising, you know, resources, funding resources. Right. But often what actually is the biggest challenge as you start to mature a little bit and get a little bit larger is hiring top talent. So finding those ways, as you're saying, to, you know, both through your own talent and then through recruiting board members and advisory board members, you know, focusing on how do you get the best people to, you know, really double down and stay with the organization, help it work through those challenges is one of the biggest areas that social entrepreneurs struggle with.
How hard is it for the founder or the co-founders to let other executives run the show? So in other words, you know, even in your case, you have room to read. You were CEO, you moved to board member. I'm sure somebody else comes in as CEO. There's all these changes that are going on when it's your baby. You know, can social entrepreneurs get in their own way?
Yeah, I mean, I think founder syndrome is not just for social entrepreneurs, but, you know, for-profit, you know, and nonprofit entrepreneurship in general, it's a huge issue. And I think that's one that's probably, you know, not talked about as much as it should be, because I think there's, particularly in social enterprises, you know, there's pretty huge burnout oftentimes as you're, you know, working to address complex problems with limited resources, limited staff. Everything is urgent. You know, it's often really about people's lives. So it feels very urgent, and that pressure, you know, can wear you down. And also, as you're saying, delegating, being able to bring, you know, new talent on, having new ideas come into the organization, keep things fresh and kind of learning from, you know, and pivoting. Those are things that, you know, oftentimes are hard to do when you're the founder and you're, you know, really think that, you know, I know what's best for this organization and letting those new ideas in. And so we worked a lot on that room to read. I think it's wonderful that I was able to step down as CEO last year and hand it over to the first non-founder CEO, and that transition
was
an internal transition. It went really well, but we spent a couple of years kind of teeing it up and making sure that we could do that well, so that you know, we didn't miss a beat as room to read. And given our mission was so important to us, we had to really keep, you know, all the kind of individual personalities out of it and really focus on what's best for the organization.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. And the more that you have the planning, you said it, you know, took time to actually make that happen. It shows on the outside.
Yeah.
When you are, you know, you want to create change, the social entrepreneur, what's the best way for these startups to kind of create awareness and grow their initiatives, get other people on board?
I mean, the most important thing I would say to really grow your initiative is to be able to tell, you know, the story of your own personal journey and passion around the cause and connect it to the bigger global context of the issue that you're trying to solve. And so, you know, you first need to be able to really clearly and compellingly articulate the problem, explain why it's such an urgent issue that needs to be addressed now, you know, why your solution to the problem, you know, and through evidence that you can demonstrate really does work. But then you may need to make all that personal, because you can already tell, just even as I'm saying this, it sometimes can feel sort of outside of people and like, how can I really influence something? And so you need to bring it back to the personal, you know, why do I care so much about this? Why am I passionate? And therefore, by extension, why should others care and devote their time and talent and resources, you know, to this mission now? And, you know, connecting that personal to the global, I think is really an important dynamic that social entrepreneurs are able to do.
Yeah, I was just going to ask a little bit about other characteristics of the social entrepreneur, because it sounds like they have to be connectors, they have to be able to tell their personal stories, so they're communicators. Are you seeing through all of your experience that, you know, there are certain characteristics that really stand out?
Definitely, you know, the passion, the charisma, being able to get people, you know, on board with their social movement they're trying to create, being creative and innovative, like, you know, any entrepreneurs, those are all really, you know, I would say ground zero for spotting, you know, great social entrepreneurs. And of course, you know, they show up in unique ways in each individual, but they're, you know, common characteristics. I often look, you know, for having also a growth mindset, you know, willingness to listen, to learn, to iterate, be self-aware and kind of adjust and adapt. And I don't think sometimes those characteristics are as focused on with social entrepreneurs, but I think, you know, similar to what we were just saying about how do you really help scale change and how do you support organizations moving from that startup phase into that more mature influential, you know, high impact phase. I think, you know, having those characteristics of being able to adapt and be flexible are so critical.
Absolutely. How did you build your team at Room to Read? I'm just curious.
Well, it's something we focused a lot on. I mean, I would spend an enormous amount of my time as a, you know, executive, both as chief operating officer and then as CEO, helping to interview and build, you know, the team around us, because it's really one of the most important things, you know, you can do is get the right people on board. And that's both, you know, in terms of their functional talent. Of course, we were looking for that, but we're also looking for organizational fit. And I think at Room to Read, we did a good job of understanding our organizational culture that was very focused on results and was dynamic and fast paced, and being able to ensure that people were bringing on board were, you know, as committed and continue to have that kind of drive that we did. And you could, you know, you have a lot of skills, but you may not necessarily fit the culture. And I think that's something that, you know, if you're an enterprise that is growing fast, you really need to focus on making sure people, you know, build on the organizational culture and keep that strong.
Do you feel that you and your co-founder or co-founders and sort of the leadership set the culture, or that was something that naturally evolved as you were growing and it really came from the people?
You know, in the early days, there was three of us that co-founded Room to Read. In the early days, yes, certainly leadership, as you're building, you know, your first 20 people, 50 people, you know, the leaders are so critical. But as we, you know, we at Room to Read, when I stepped down, we were over, you know, 1,500 staff worldwide in 15 countries.
Wow.
So you can no longer know everybody in that same way that you did, right? And so then you really had to find ways to have, you know, teams and, you know, mid-level manager continued on building the culture and keeping the culture. And that really meant being able to articulate it. You still had to obviously model it from the top, but you also had to find ways to articulate really clearly what the culture was and what the expectations were, and find other ways through, you know, your performance management and your hiring practices and in all of those things to reinforce that culture. Cause it couldn't just be as personal connections, as it was in the early days.
Sure. And did you find that, you know, as you built your culture, that the folks on board were more willing to share and they were getting excited? You know, did you see a lot of, you know, of course, brands, organizations, they all want to communicate. We're out there on social media, we're doing more traditional marketing. But did you also see people within sharing and getting out there and being your advocates?
Absolutely. And I think to me, what's amazing now and how things have changed is the level of data that you're able to collect and then be able to, you know, more importantly, analyze and reflect on. And so one of the things we really did with Room to Read in terms of our culture was challenge ourselves to understand what was really working, but even more importantly, what was not working, and to engage in those conversations of learning and reflection, whether it was in a country office or regional teams or the global teams. And I think that's really unique now because of the ability to use technology to collect data, to analyze information that is, you know, is unheard of before, right? And so that really allows you, I think, in many ways, to help that learning cycle continue.
Absolutely. And, you know, it is amazing because the amount of data that we have at our fingertips, I feel like when I started out myself, I never really thought that I would be diving into the data. You know, and even as a communications strategist, now that's something, and I have my MBA, so of course, I always had stats and calculus and accounting end users approach. It was there, but it didn't interest me. And now I'm so much more interested and fascinated by it. Were you always fascinated with data, or is it something that you kind of learned along the way?
No, definitely. I was always an incredibly results driven, you know, data driven person. And that, you know, we used to always say at Room to Read, you know, what gets measured gets done. So, you know, as leaders, you know, what you look at, what data you look at, what you analyze, what you talk about, what you reward as good work, where you dig in, where there's problems. I mean, that sends so many signals throughout the organization. And so I think that's always just how I've showed up in the world too, just how my mind works. But certainly that was a big part then of the Room to Read culture as well.
Absolutely. And what about social media? Just curious, are you, you know, for Room to Read or for other social entrepreneurs who are looking to create big change globally, is social media becoming something that is a must or not so much?
Well, it's certainly a must, but I will say I have pretty different approaches to this personally and professionally. Professionally, you know, for a cause like Room to Read, where you're building a social movement, even now at Echidna Giving, where we're trying to influence the way the whole girls' education sector is looked at and analyzed and is supported. We're trying to, you know, build an ecosystem that is robust around girls' education. You know, we have to find ways to interact more broadly through social media and technology, to creating those platforms that allow people to have conversations about what's really working for girls. And so that's, you know, a big part professionally, I think, of how the world works now. But I will say, from my personal side, you know, I'm not sure that I find social media that value add in my own life. I feel like it's very hard sometimes to not get caught up on just looking at trends and not really knowing whether those are real trends or whether they're just what people are, you know, sort of saying as the glossy side of things. And so I think for myself, you know, I really want to be careful that I spend my time thinking deeply as well, and not just at that surface level. And even in conversations with my own daughter now, who's 13, you know, this is a common, you know, gotten her first phone this year and is, you know, looking at things like Instagram. Now we have a lot of conversations about this because I think you can also overdo it. And, you know, the reality is that there is a lot of content out there and we're not all able to absorb it. So I, you know, quality of, you know, and the strategy sometimes over quantity is more important to me in the social media, you know, arena.
I agree. I love that you said, be careful and watch out. You know, you kind of have to dig deeper. You can't just take things on surface level, but it is quality always over quantity. So I'm just going to ask you, Erin, to hold your thoughts for just a moment. We're going to take a super quick break, give some love to our sponsor. And when we get back, we're going to learn more about Erin, her career, and some maybe aha moments.
Creating brand loyalty requires a unique blend of strategic communications and innovative technology. Yesterday's techniques won't work. Today, you have an opportunity to expand your communications approach with fresh, creative, and effective ways to power up your brand voice through new channels and to interact with more value and meaning. Pure Performance Communications will work with you to move audiences from awareness to action and impact. You'll foster greater engagement and forge stronger relationships along the way. Let us help you uncover what's holding you back and help you to carve out a marketing and PR roadmap to success. Visit us at pureperformancecom.com. That's pureperformancecom with two M's.com. Now back to Women Worldwide with Deirdre Breckenridge.
Welcome back to the show. Erin Ganju and I were just chatting about her book and the social entrepreneur. Erin, this is a really interesting discussion. You know, I had mentioned in the last segment about aha moments. So yes. let's kick it off there. What do you think was your biggest aha moment as you were sort of moving along your career path?
Well, I think, as I said earlier, definitely founding Room to Read, you know, was in my traditional, if I would say, kind of aha moment. And that was, you know, so important in terms of being able to care deeply about something like international education and girls' education and wanting to make a bigger change. And I felt like I was having in the for-profit world. And so, you know, digging in and saying, you know what, I'm going to dedicate my life to helping bring this education to more communities around the world. That was so critical. And it's been definitely, you know, the more of a gift to me than anything I've ever done to be able to be a part of something like Room to Read. I will say that, you know, more recently though, the other hardest aha moment was being able to understand when to step down as CEO. And that's also a really, as we've, you know, we're talking about earlier, a really hard decision. Winning, you know, thinking for me about what did I want to be the future of Room to Read, and knowing that one of the things that I really wanted to be able to represent was also a great transition and how to do that well. And so I think that was another big aha. And it also freed up my mind to think more, as I'm now at Echidna Giving, about, you know, greater systems level change in education. And how do we not only support one organization and its scale like Room to Read, but what do we need to do to ensure there are many organizations that are thriving in the girls' education ecosystem? And so I feel like it's also, you know, when the older you get and the wiser and, you know, you get, sometimes it's important to think about how do you think about the whole system. And that's allowed me in this new role to do something. So it's been a great transition for Room to Read and for me personally.
That's really good. You know, you said something that kind of struck a chord with me when you talked about knowing when to step down and how to make that transition. We always discuss great leaders. Great leaders are brave. Great leaders are creative. Great leaders know when to step down and to make a smooth transition. We don't talk about that so much, but it's really important as a leader.
Yeah, I think for great leaders, it's important to know when it's not about you and it's about the bigger cause, right? And that's something that you don't always hear about in leadership. But I think certainly Jim Collins and Good to Great talked about the level 5 leadership and what it really means to make sure that leadership is about the bigger mission. And I'm a big believer in that, you know, we need to realize when we're getting caught up in it as opposed to being able to support it. And I mean, I would say I was always able to balance that, but I think certainly in the social sector, it's important to support founders in thinking about how do you look at the longer term sustainability of the organization as, you know, priority number one.
Yeah, excellent. I'm just curious, were there entrepreneurs at all in your family or, you know, were you surrounded by folks who were looking at the greater cause and change globally? Where did this all come from?
Well, not necessarily entrepreneurs. I mean, I would say education and the social sector was in my kind of roots. My father was a professor and my mother was a social worker. And so there's certainly kind of the combinations if you see those in Room to Read. And I was lucky to have a lot of strong, independent women in my life who modeled, you know, possibilities for me. And I feel like female mentors and role models, you know, are essential in my path to success. You know, as we say, you can't be what you don't see, right? And so for even our girls' education program at Room to Read, we really focus on having female role models and mentors so that girls can, you know, look up and see women ahead of them that are really, you know, paving the way for them. And that to me was always an important part of my life as well. And having great, both in business and personally, having great women that I was able to use as role models.
Is there any one influencer or role model who stands out in your mind?
Well, not surprisingly, for most people, you ask that question, often it's a parent. And I would say my mother was an incredible one. She got her master's at a time when most, you know, women didn't. She actually wrote her thesis on why there were so few women in senior management. And that was in like the early 80s, right?
And so
she was already questioning you know, the glass ceilings before I think, you know, it was even developed as a concept that, you know, we're seeing sort of wanting to break through those glass ceilings now. I also had a female boss at Unilever, which was one of the few senior women in a very male dominated, you know, manufacturing company that I learned a lot from. And really, again, was a role model for me about how you could develop a career in a very male dominated industry. And so those, you know, are women that stick out to me as some of the people that I've modeled my career after.
That's great. What about, I want to talk a little bit about success, because clearly you've had success, Room to Read, and now where you are at Echidna, but success, because it's different for each professional. How do you define it for yourself? Maybe success on a day-to-day basis, and also success over a long period of time.
Well, for me, it's always really been about being able to see my place and driving results and creating impact and how I can, you know, connect my contributions to that greater impact. And I would say the other thing for me is being part of a dynamic team. You know, it's never been so much about titles or salary. And I say that knowing very well and having had to fight, you know, oftentimes very hard in my life as a woman for the right title and salary. So I'm not saying I should be discounted in any way, but my personal definition of success has been much more about whether I can connect to the greater results we're seeing. And I think that's why I like the social sector so much. You know, you're working on solving big complex problems where the results have real impact on the quality of people's lives. And for, you know, many, it takes a, you know, very collaborative approach into building a social movement to create that systems change. And so you're working, you know, with a team of passionate people. And even now I take at my work at Echidna Giving, you know, we're playing our part on ensuring that we're delivering on the promise of girls' education to ensure girls have better lives. And so it's all about collaborating and making sure the whole sector works for girls. And that to me is, you know, really what drives me.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's awesome. When, you know, I was just thinking about for a second, the, how everybody looks at success differently and how, you know, driving the results and being collaborative in the organization. Do you find that people are naturally collaborative, or, you know, are there any challenges with respect to that? Or when you were at Room to Read, was it just normal for people to work in teams?
I do think, and for the most part, people are naturally collaborative. And if you look at, you know, most surveys of why people stay at organizations, you know, they say it's because of my colleagues. You know, I love the team I'm with. I love my manager. I love the people around me. You know, those are very common reasons. I mean, people don't stay, you know, oftentimes for, you know, for a particular salary or title level or things that you might think are what, you know, is driving those decisions. Often about who they're working with and how they're all, you know, rowing together and, you know, achieving goals together. That's what motivates people. So I do think that's pretty natural.
Now, what about women? Women on teams, women, whether you want to look at women entrepreneurs or women in business, do you think that they're having bigger challenges that, I mean, in your experience that you've seen? And what are some of those challenges? Because I know that you said something about how, you know, getting the promotion or the pay that you want. How are women navigating?
Absolutely. I do think that it's, you know, women, and that's that level of collaboration and commitment to collaboration, I think women do very well. It's very, it comes very natural to us. And in many ways, we have to somewhat talk ourselves out of doing that all the time. Because what you see in a lot, you know, a lot of the research is that women oftentimes need to take more credit for what they do and not always give the credit to the team so that they can kind of advocate for themselves and, you know, in those promotions or opportunities to, you know, take on leadership roles. So I would say, you know, from my perspective, you know, in the C-suite and in boardrooms, you know, it often is really still a boys' club. And that's been something I've struggled with and, you know, almost every organization I've been with, including Room to Read, where it's been, you know, the boardroom was often, you know, had more men on it than women, just by the definition of who is making a lot of the funding decisions and, you know, how boards get developed. And so I think we need to, you know, advocate stronger for ensuring that we have more diversity. As you see a lot now, more discussion about that. It became clear in my career, I think, that I didn't advocate enough for myself sometimes. I thought the quality and kind of quantity of my work would speak for itself, but often you have to learn to market yourselves. And I think, you know, men are sometimes better just naturally looking at relationships more transactionally and kind of, you know, asking for help and pitching themselves. And I think as women, you know, we can tend to be more relationship based in our connections. And so we have to work sometimes, at least I know from my own experience, I had to work sometimes to think more transactionally and think about, you know, connecting and asking for favors and promoting myself in ways, you know, throughout my whole career that were important for me to learn those skills, succeed in a relatively still kind of male dominated business world.
And that can be hard if you're not used to doing that. I'm trying to think of which guest it was. It might have been Fran Hauser, who had said that, you know, there are so many differences between men and women in the workplace. But, you know, even in terms of a new job opportunity that comes up within your organization, a woman, if she only felt 60% qualified to take right. the role, she wouldn't. But a man would. And would be able to, you know, market himself and be promoted. And I think that's fascinating.
Definitely. I think those are very common things you hear from most women, at least in my, you know, generation. And I think those are things that I hope, and I actually do think in the workplace that is coming up today in the younger generation, this is not going to be as common of a theme. I feel like there is a lot more of that equalizing, you know, happening. And so I, you know, I'm hopeful for the future, but I know that's something that certainly, that I've, you know, struggled with and had to really push myself to do better.
Yeah. I mean, I hope generations to come can learn to market themselves and to have that, be able to step out of their comfort zone, even if 40%, they don't know what right. they're going right. to expect, you know, but go with that 60% for the new role. I mean, there certainly is in any organization and any professional, you're going to get your stress. When you're creating change and it's social and it's global, there's also emotions involved. So what would you say about tips for managing stress and emotions?
Well, this is one thing I do really appreciate about the social sector that I really believe is important, and I hope in many ways is a role model the social sector can help influence the for-profit sector on, is that you really are able to show real emotions and be authentic, because what we're dealing with are such important issues, and we're dealing with people's lives. You know, it's seen as a leader, you know, to be very important to show that passion and that connection to the mission and those emotions. And so ultimately, you know, people trust you more and feel more connected to your social enterprise if they see the leader being very authentic, passionate, you know, transparent, honest. Those are all things that are very valued, you know, in the social sector. And to a certain extent, in larger group settings, you know, you can't be too emotional. I mean, that's, you know, it's always can be the case where you want to be able to be a strong, competent leader. But what I think when things got stressful and tough, as they certainly did many times, and, you know, as you're growing and expanding into new countries and facing new challenges, I always found it was important, you know, at least one-to-one or in small groups, to having those heart-to-heart real conversations about the critical things, and being able to move through tough, you know, situations by working through the emotions together. I mean, it's we put so much of our heart and soul into our jobs. You know, it's where we spend the most of our time, you know, every day. And you need to be able to show up and be your whole self and be authentic and talk about what matters. And I think that's something that, you know, it has been important to me in terms of being able to build a strong, you know, loyal team around me is really developing those strong relationships with people.
Absolutely. I think it comes from the top. So if you're seeing leaders who are able to show emotions and being authentic, right? If you let your passion out, then obviously people are going to connect to you. If that filters down into the organization, that can be powerful.
Yes.
Absolutely. I've been studying a lot of the interviews that I've done on Women Worldwide, and I like to listen to social conversations through a social media monitoring tool. And I like to look at combinations of conversations using leaders with words like brave and courage and creativity. And it's really interesting because the tools I use let you know the passion of those conversations and the reach and how many people are talking. But somehow when it comes to, and I'm sort of building this as a into a proprietary system, but when it comes to leaders and emotions or feelings and things that are really human, there's much less conversation.
Interesting.
Around that. It is really, really interesting. So, you know, for you to say showing your real emotions, that means a lot. And I don't think that just is, you know, for this, the social entrepreneur creating change. I think this goes across the board.
I think it goes back to that, you know, you can't be what you don't see. Like it goes back to role modeling, right? So if we can model what, you know, showing up at work is as your whole self and being able to bring emotions into the workplace and you know, productive and healthy ways, right? Where we're connecting more to the passion of what drives us all. I think that's, you know, that sounds like it from what you're saying, from what you're seeing out there is that that's a really important dynamic to talk more about.
Absolutely. You know, the landscape is so noisy. There's a lot of shouting going on out there and not a lot of feeling. And sometimes I feel like listening that could lead to bigger and better things. And I don't know if that's a function of the technology and the social media and the ability to just, you know, join so many different conversations and even be anonymous behind what you say. But I don't know. I think authenticity from any angle is going to be the best approach.
And I think this piece that you're saying in our political discourse, right? It's the whole you know, fear versus hope, you know, sort of debate, right? You can use fear as such a powerful, determinant of where the conversation goes and how things get, you know, discussed. And that's really compelling, right? But we need to get better at also being able to show emotions that are positive too, and hope and, and, you know, looking at the future in ways that are compelling and exciting and have a lot of, you know, the positive strength behind it. And that would be something that I think that, you know, certainly at Room to Read, we did really well is, it, you know, education was not, you know, about what people didn't have, right? It was more about the reason why why parents want their child to have a better life and why they so strongly, you know, focus on education is because it's about that, you know, hope for the future, right? And so I think there's a lot we can learn in sort of being able to tap into those positive emotions as well.
Oh, I agree 100%. Hope, compassion, and education is so important. So I love what you've done with Room to Read and where it's going. So what about social media in general? You had mentioned, you know, personally, you understand, just sort of, you could take it for what it is, but often you have to dig deeper into it. Is there any way professionally, or are you using social media or technology to help you to save time, or, you know, any tools or tips or apps that you use?
Well, one of the things I think is interesting in understanding, you know, how to support, you know, again, broader systems level changes, something that we're working on at Echidna Giving is really mapping the ecosystem around girls' education and looking at this as an open source database that people can use to understand, you know, who's working in girls' education? What is the evidence showing us about what works for girls? How do you make connections if you're looking, you know, in other countries and you want to know, you know, who specifically in Malawi or India or, you know, or Peru is working on something, you know, around girls' education? Who are the researchers that are helping build that evidence? Those types of connections, I think there's, you know, it's amazing what technology can do in that type of ecosystem mapping, because it just cuts down, you know, so many cycles of, you know, being able to ask somebody and go talk to somebody and get referred to somebody, all those, you know, hours that we used to spend in something like technology by just querying, you know, a database and being able to get that information back and immediately making those connections is super powerful. And in international development, this is, you know, revolutionary, right? So I think that's exciting to me when you think about technology in those ways. I mean, certainly when you think about it in terms of monitoring evaluation and being able to understand what works better in the nonprofit space and focusing on more investing, you know, on what's really working. Those are exciting things that I think technology has, you know, enabled us to do. I think the, you know, the social media side of it is important often for telling your story, right? For getting your message out there. But I think, you know, the part, you know, as you've mentioned too, is that, you know, there's a lot of noise. And so I think the hard part is how do we cut through some of that noise to focus on quality? And that's still something I struggle with in terms of the right amount of time and level of effort to put into, you know, to some of the social media apps. I mean, I use LinkedIn. I'm fairly active, you know, on the LinkedIn network because that's sort of a very professional network to make connections. But it's harder for me, you know, personally, and my team, you know, at Room to Read will probably laugh because they used to take, you know, screenshots of tweets and send it to me by email because they knew that I would not be on Twitter looking at it, right? So I'm a little bit of a Luddite when it comes to, you know, some of the technology like that. I'm not necessarily going to be the early adopter.
But they still know how to reach you. I know what you're paying attention to. That's so funny. Well, technology can be a game changer. And you know what? Everybody uses it differently to be effective.
Exactly. To each their own.
Yes, exactly. What advice do you want to give to women worldwide listeners out there who are thinking about creating some change and, you know, impact?
Well, I am a big believer in taking risks and not being afraid to try something. I mean, if you know, you will never succeed if you don't try. And so I just think that's so important in terms of being able, you know, particularly to, you know, younger people starting out in their careers and thinking about, you know, what do they want to do? You know, do it differently, you know, take the less traveled path. I mean, you know, try and risk, you know, particularly when you are in an earlier career, it's, you know, you can do that and you can pivot a lot and it builds new skills and, you know, new avenues. I also would say, though, as you get, you know, as you look at the social sector and you look at how it's developed and really, again, you know, the purpose behind our book, Scaling Social Change, is that, you know, you don't always need to invent a new idea or start a new organization. I mean, sometimes some of the innovations that have already been started are in very nascent, you know, early stages, and you can join forces with others and contribute, you know, to an already established organization, you know, or to a team that's working and collectively leverage, you know, your ideas and your networks, and be better off, you know, working together. And so I always think that collaboration piece is also important to add into, to it, because I think there's a lot more collaboration we can be doing to reach higher impact.
Excellent advice. Thank you so much. Last question, super easy. Where can people find out more about you, your work, and your book?
Well, certainly the Room to Read website at www.roomtoread.org has resources on the book and international education in general. We at Echidna Giving are at www.echidnagiving.org, and it has great resources and research on the power of investing in girls' education globally. So those are two wonderful resources, and we'd love to see you at both of those locations.
Awesome. Erin, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us on Women Worldwide. We appreciate your journey, your time, and everything that you shared today. So well, thank you.
Thank you for highlighting this, the powerful work of Women Worldwide.
Oh, thank you. And I also want to thank all of you Women Worldwide listeners out there. You're helping us to grow our network, and we so appreciate it. Keep sharing the stories of amazing guests like Erin and what they are doing to make the world a better place. So you know what? Shout out on Twitter, Facebook, rate us on iTunes, come to the website, sign up for our emails. And you know what? We look forward to hearing more from you. So that's it, friends. Until our next episode, stay focused, energized, and feeling empowered. Thank you.